You're listening to All Marine Radio, broadcasting from Costa Mesa, California, on the All Warrior Radio Network. Listen to this, all right? So, the Marine Corps has got its motivational new vision video out, okay? So, you want a little dose of motivation to start the program off? Do you? Do you really? All right, here you go.
The battle to keep our nation and its people safe has changed. Our world has become more dangerous and more unpredictable. And those who seek to cause harm and destruction take that opportunity all too often. But America has a powerful response.
Okay, now I want you to listen to this noise one more time, because I'll tell you what, I don't care how often in your life you hear this shit, this noise is one of the best noises ever, right? And it's a sound. The president would never know this, but this is what locked and loaded sounds like, okay? And when you hear it, talk about motivated. All right, you ready? This is what, listen, you're going to hear a metal sound. That's bolts sliding home.
But America has a powerful response.
Boom!
America has its Marines. A naval expeditionary force in readiness. Extremely adaptable and agile. Prepared to operate inside contested maritime spaces. Built to win our nation's battles and create order from chaos anytime, anywhere. The Fleet Marine Force is forward deployed and forward postured, deterring potential adversaries and safeguarding key maritime terrain. We are first on the scene, first to help, first to contain a brewing crisis, and if required to do so, first to fight. We work and fight in partnership with the Navy, which makes us instantly mobile, amphibious, and lethal. And our self-sustained forces are able to keep peace, bring aid, or take the fight anywhere on the planet for as long as it takes to buy time, create decision space, or enable our larger joint forces. We are flexible, scalable, and we practice warfare that outmaneuvers adversaries and exploits vulnerabilities. But a force like this is about more than mobility or equipment. It's about Marines. Recruiting and retaining the very best defines who we are. We seek selfless young men and women of character and virtue and challenge them to earn our title. Marines themselves are the greatest weapons in our arsenal, each polished and capable, battle-tested, determined to win.
You must do whatever is said of yourself at all times.
And never quit or give up.
Steeped in our core values of honor, courage, and commitment, Marines bring moral, physical, and intellectual strength to every situation. And when their time in uniform is done, they use those qualities to continue to serve their communities. But before Marines can ever fight our battles, they learn to work together to overcome doubt, fear, and weakness, and become capable of making smart and decisive combat decisions. It's a special skill honed across more than 240 years of defending this nation.
You know you want to sign up right now, don't you? Don't you?
And it's made the Marine fighting spirit legendary. Strategic environments are changing, characterized by evolving technologies and a fight for accurate information. It's a chaotic environment that calls for a next-generation approach. As the world's premier naval expeditionary fighting force, we operate across air,
you know, there's a lot of stuff in here. But the one thing that's not a joke, that's straight up legit, the world's premier expeditionary fighting force. That's no joke, man. That's straight up legit.
Land, sea, and cyberspace. Embracing information environment operations and integrating as part of the combined joint force, Marines bring unmatched combined arms capability. From the great battles of the past and to those ahead that will surely test our nation, the Marines exist now and have always existed for a singular purpose: to fight and to win. And as our world becomes more complex, we'll continue to build a fighting force that can counter every threat to our country. This is your Marine Corps. These are your Marines.
And then it ends with, you know, the Eagle, Globe, and Anchor. Underneath it, it says Marines, the few, the proud. Did you hear the bolts? Right? That was an 8th and I move, though. It wasn't Marines letting the bolt slide home, getting ready to go, man. Hold on, you can hear it one more time. Listen for the bolts. Ugh, I missed it. Hold on.
These are your Marines.
Hear that metal noise? I love that shit. All right, hold on. Let me go back to about 18 seconds. That's 4 seconds, 7 seconds, 9 seconds. All right, listen to the sound of the bolts sliding home.
It's become more dangerous and more unpredictable. And those who seek to cause harm and destruction take that opportunity all too often. But America has a powerful response.
Yeah! The response is the sound of a bolt going home at about the 22-second mark of that video. That's what that is, right? Motivational. Motor. Got a lot of motivation. Anyway, good Thursday morning to you. So, I mean, you know what? I love that shit. A lot of people look at it, roll their eyes, like, whoa, and they try to be all salty ass. Not me, man. I love that. I love our motivational shit. Yeah, I do. Yeah, it's a kid in me, right? It's a kid in me, but I do. I like that shit. Anyway, let's see. Good morning to you. All right, what do I do in here? All right, let me tell you what we're going to do today. Lynch and Kenny are going to join me in about an hour, and we're going to talk about war in the South China Sea. What did they think it would look like? So started kind of an interesting conversation with Grant yesterday, and looking at China's geography, China not in the best spot, man. And guess who is? This is crazy. The nation that is this incredible experiment in democracy, right? That has unleashed more human beings to do more creative things on the planet, happens to be in the single greatest place that you could be geographically to promote those values. And dare I say, that's probably one of the reasons why, you know, we've had, as Americans, we've had the run that we have had. Geography is part of it. We have two gigantic oceans that protect us. And anybody that would come do us harm can only do us harm if they're a substantial naval power. And most are not. Yeah. And even if you are a substantial naval power, then what? What can you do to the United States? So anywho, I was looking at geography yesterday. As I noticed, China's in a bit of a predicament. They are they have one coast, right, to the Pacific Ocean, and the South China Sea and East China Sea, specifically. And they're attempting to open up other routes to other bodies of water, but those could be easily shut down and destroyed at a moment's notice, should we care to. And so when you look at the problem from the Chinese perspective, you know, even owning the South China Sea isn't enough. Even owning the South China Sea isn't enough. South China Sea, honestly, I mean, it's relevant to Vietnam. In my opinion, it's relevant to the containment strategy of China, right? But it's largely, they're still contained within the first island belt. And the first island belt would be, from south to north, Malaysia, Philippines, Taiwan, Japan, and Korea. They're locked into that. And they know that. And so, anyway, we're going to talk about that with Lynch and Kenny. Get their thoughts on what they think of what I thought was a pretty interesting little discussion with Grant Newsham yesterday. If you didn't listen to that, you should check it out. Now again, I know that people send in emails saying, you know, well, the cyber thing's going to be huge. Okay, yeah, it'll be huge for them. It'll be huge for us, right? They're going to explode, right? Those electronic pulse things, right? Okay, and we'll do the same thing. So let's just say everything goes back to there is no internet when that event starts. And there's both cyber shit that happens that both nations quickly shut down their internets. Yeah, boom, it goes off. Your cell phone doesn't work anymore. How does the world communicate? Nobody's got a landline, and there are no payphones. Can't communicate once the cell towers go off, and the internet gets shut off. Yeah, interesting. So again, under the backdrop of all that, we close with the Chinese in the South China Sea. Is there any need for us to go into the South China Sea? So anyway, we talk about all that. Okay, but let me tell you what we're going to do in the first hour. I want to play the rest of John Bolton's question and answer, and that's about 30 minutes, okay? So I got to get to a few things. So the United States Marine Corps Band makes today official good morning to you. Whoops, hold on. I promise you, they really do make it official right now. Oops. Maybe the third time's a charm? And this is dedicated to whoever made that video, all right? And specifically the dude or the girl who said, hey, let's put that sound of the bolts going home on live rounds in that son of a bitch, okay? Because that needs to be in there, right? Exactly. Right? Gives me goosebumps just thinking about that noise. And then you know what you hear after that? Let's go.
Woo! You're betraying your whole life if you don't say what you think, and you don't say it honestly and bluntly.
It defines us. It defines warriors like Gunnery Sergeant John Canley, a leader who led from the front. With his Marines outnumbered, he pushed forward during the Battle of Way City, standing tall during firefights and throwing himself into harm's way to keep his fellow Marines safe.
The only thing I was doing was just responding. The Marines, the young Marines, it shows them that it's not do as I say, it's do as I do. And just being that close with them brings motivation to them.
During firefights, when we'd be all hugging Mother Earth, he'd be standing up directing us. And I think if you talk to every Alpha Company Marine, we're amazed that he was never shot.
For this campus had prepared him well. I'm very confident that, thank you very much. If this was vodka, it'd be a lot better speech. But I'm not supposed to glamorize alcohol anymore, so young folks, you ignore what I just said.
What keeps you awake at night?
Nothing. I keep other people awake at night.
If you don't love your Marine, then you really ought to get out. The only reason I stuck around that little paying outfit 40 years is for the absolute pleasure of serving alongside cocky, rambunctious, disciplined, selfless, unbelievably selfless young Marine. And the infantry got its name, infant soldier, infantry, young soldier. And I enjoyed being around them. And in the military, it's all about the team. And so if you don't know the team players beyond simply their rank and last name, you don't care about them deeply. I mean, just go up to Bethesda any time you want to see the cost of war and see the ranks on the rooms that you're walking into. Lance Corporal here, Lance Corporal there, PFC here, Sergeant there, Lieutenant. If you don't care about these guys, don't expect them to care about what's important to you. They're putting their lives on the line.
I had a Vietnam vet tell me one time, Jeremiah, you know, PTSD, it's like having a cage in your brain, it's like having a cage full of monkeys. The goal is to keep the monkeys in the cage, because once them bastards make the jailbreak, all hell breaks loose, so you want to keep them in the cage.
Once you're out of the Corps, you know, it's your responsibility to live your life in a way that would honor those that were with you and died. I mean, don't waste your life. Goodness, do something meaningful, and don't be going out there saying, look, oh, woe is me, I'm a poor veteran, or I'm a disabled veteran. Well, yeah, I am a disabled veteran. But, you know, we can't have that kind of attitude. We've got to show people that, hey, we care about our country, we care about what happens to everyone. Marine Corps changed me. It made me a better man, but I don't know a Marine that wouldn't tell you the same thing, Mike.
We just have to execute. And we are executing every day, and Sergeant Major and I are very proud of what you do. Doesn't mean we can't get better. We don't want to make a mistake to learn. We don't want to lose to learn. We cannot lose if we have to go fight. We got to do what these Marines did here 75 years ago. Persevere against difficult, challenging conditions and odds and win. You got to win.
All right, time to check the weather. It is currently cloudy and 79 in Quantico, the crossroads of the Marine Corps. Sunny in 86, so got warmer at Camp Lejeune. It is clear and 61 in 29 Palms, so fall has come to the desert in California. And the cold spot right now is Camp Pendleton, where it is sunny and 56 degrees. Raining in 73 and dark at Camp Smith in Hawaii. In Okinawa, it is dark, cloudy in 77, so they've cooled off. In Ramadi, it's cooled off as well. Early evening, 93 degrees under clear skies, so cooled off there. And fall is coming to Afghanistan. It is currently evening, clear, and 80 degrees. at the home of All Marine Radio at the Costa Mesa Newport Beach area of Southern California. Sunny and 62, looking for a high of 76. Shithole weather updates, or SHW Thursday as it's known, from Worcester, Massachusetts. 47 degrees, mostly cloudy, winds are calm. Worcester is the birthplace of Robert Goddard, in case you don't know, creator of the first American rocket. Yeah, it's also 754 miles north of Camp Lejeune. See, there you have it. Not so Pleasantville, Pennsylvania. Currently cloudy, light rain, 59 degrees, looking for a high of 75. Winds out of the northwest at 8, scattered thunderstorms later. It's freaking awful. Cheer me up, please. Sorry, suck it up, man. Whine about your weather. East Central Saskatchewan, shithole weather. Churchbridge, Saskatchewan, approximately 200 miles north of Minot, North Dakota. Currently overcast and 36 degrees. This afternoon's going to be partly cloudy, looking for a high of only 48 degrees. Fall's falling. Vacaville, California, currently 47 degrees and clear. 6 miles an hour out of the southwest, looking for a high of 79 today. All right. Let me do some news headlines, and I'll do color commentary of John Bolton. But I want to play his question and answer stuff because I think it's significant because some of the questions are pretty good. All right, things you should know. Sergeant Stripes, 22 paratroopers got injured in a jump in Mississippi. I guess when the winds near the surface of the earth. Blew them, you know. So again, nobody had life-threatening injuries. Army's UPC uniform, their digital uniform, has been retired, along with the Navy Blueberries, officially, as of September 30th. So that is in the news. And then, this is crazy, right? Misawa Maintenance Commander fired for loss of confidence. So you're talking about a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force makes top of the fold news and Stars and Stripes for being relieved. I think that's bullshit. You know, just me. Saw something interesting in USNI news, right? There's a video. It's entitled, but listen to the name of the exercise. Navy fires new littoral combat ship missile in Pacific SYNC-X, right? Now, SYNC-X, how would you expect that to be, right? Spelled SYNC-X. That's the name of the exercise. Well, SYNC in the military used to mean Commander in Chief, S-I-N-C. C, Commander in C, SYNC. SYNC-X, right? Or it could be we're synchronizing, S-Y-N-C, right? But oh no, they didn't spell it that way. SYNC-X is spelled S-I-N-K, motherfucker. That's right, China. We're talking to you. Boom. What? Exactly. Yeah, S-I-N-K-E-X. Thought that was kind of cool. There's also a story in Marine Corps Times written by Megan Eckstein. I'm a fan of Megan's. Berger, Marines focused on China in developing new way to fight in the Pacific. So I think this is built around the video that you just heard, right? And so Megan writes an article talking about the Commandant's planning guidance, the new video that got sent out, and war in the Pacific. I was trying to see. I don't think there's a story in Marine Corps Times that I would talk to you about. And there's not. Okay, so there's a couple other stories I want to get to. You know, often I talk about the stuff that you see, the bullshit you see on the news is not your country. Okay, let me tell you about the country that you do live in. Okay, 2,000 plus people, and this story made the rounds, I didn't get to it yesterday. 2,000 plus people attend a funeral of a Florida veteran with no next of kin family. 2,000 people spontaneously showed up, right, to honor somebody they didn't even know. He was an 80-year-old Army veteran. They came in Harley Davidsons and Mercedes. They walked into a service with the aid of canes and service dogs. Women clasped bouquets of flowers. Men gripped American flags, large and small. He was a resident of Naples, Florida. Now, that's a country that you live in. So this other bullshit that you see on TV all the time is exactly that. It's people selling newspapers. It's people buying clicks. Now, the story that I want to talk about is something in the Wall Street Journal, which means I can't read the whole article. And it's about Iran opening a second front. With Israel. And the Wall Street Journal is really expensive. Ooh. Hold on. So it's an... Oh, see what I mean? Son of a bitch. It's written by a guy named Jonathan Speier. S-P-Y-E-R. Okay? And Speier is a director of the Middle East Center for Reporting and Analysis and a research fellow at the Jerusalem Institute for Strategy and Security and at the Middle East Forum. He is the author of Days of the Fall, A Reporter's Journey in the Syria and Iraq War. So it catches a little bit of an eye, right? The Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps and its proxies control Syria land near the Golan Heights. Israel is fighting off Iranian expansion across the Middle East, but danger for the Jewish state lurks near its own borders. Painstaking work by Iran's Islamic Republican Guard Corps and their loyal proxies has succeeded in laying the groundwork for a second Iranian front with Israel in the Golan Heights. The first front is to Israel's north in southern Lebanon. The Golan, which Israel won from Syria in 1967, lies further east. Though Israel rules the skies, the Syrian land adjoining Israel's border appears increasingly to belong to Iran. Reports from both Israelis and Syrian opposition groups have revealed glimpses of the methods of the Iranians and their allies have employed to build a military infrastructure on the Syrian side of the Golan. One is the Iranian conquest of Syria, a report published last month by the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs. The authors are two retired senior military intelligence officers, Brigadier General Shimon Sapira and Colonel Jacques Nera. They explain how Iranian and Hezbollah fighters have crept methodically westward from the Syrian lava fields of Lajat, 40 miles from the Golan Heights in Syria's southwest, to the broken nation's Quintara province, which is even closer. The Iranian element, made up of IRGC, Lebanese Hezbollah, and the local Syrians have recruited, is tightly woven into border villages and the official Syrian security forces. That much is clear from the locations of the four permanent bases used by Lebanese Hezbollah in southwestern Syria. One is Al-Harak, within the area controlled, blah, blah, blah. So you get the gist of it. All right? And if you recall the last time Israel went into Lebanon, they got punched in the face pretty good. They likened the fighting, and I want to say some of the literature I read, they went back to Marine Corps tactics on Iwo Jima, because that was, in fact, what Hezbollah had done in southern Lebanon. They had fortified that son of a bitch so strongly. And they, you know, with the Israeli air defense superiority, right, it's what General Kuribashi did on Iwo Jima. They fought from below ground. So anyway, pretty interesting little article there. Yeah, pretty interesting little article. The top five stories in Early Bird, real quick. At least seven dead in a fiery crash of a World War II B-17 Flying Fortress. Now, I will tell you this. I don't know why that's number one. It's a recreational plane, and I'm not sure the impact that has on the DOD, but whatever. The person who does these rankings ought to be fired, in my opinion. Right? Ought to be allowed to retire. All right. Thanks for your service. See you later. But anyway, people get on these aircraft and ride them all the time. Right? A World War II era B-17 bomber with 13 people on board crashed and burned Wednesday at New England's second busiest airport after encountering mechanical trouble on takeoff. Seven of the 13 were killed. Number two, U.S. Embassy in Somalia opens nearly three decades after leaving. How about that? The United States says it has reopened its embassy in Somalia nearly three decades after the country collapsed into civil war and the U.S. military airlifted the ambassador to safety. So good luck to everybody who's there. Good luck to everybody who's protecting that thing because we just set up a target. Number three, North Korea says submarine launch missile test has succeeded. You know, submarines are going to be a dying breed very quickly because, you know, and so the issue for submarines is going to be their ability to defeat radar, just like aviation platforms. And the future of submarines is they will be unmanned. Yeah. Because you're going to have all these little, you know, water drones out there pinging. Ping, 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 ping. And you're going to get found. And as soon as you get found, you're going to get killed by another little drone who's got a missile. Bing, 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 bing. Yeah. So you better be good at sub shit. But North Korea rattling their saber again. Number four, and we're going to hear about North Korea here in a second. Number four, Afghanistan security advisor says hardline Taliban members defecting to ISIS merging with Al-Qaeda. Interesting. Interesting. Number five, Bell enshrouds Invictus, its answer for the Army's future attack reconnaissance aircraft. Attack reconnaissance aircraft. So, attack reconnaissance. Replacing the Cobra? Replacing Black Hawk gunships? Pretty sleek looking thing. Got a tail section that's a lot reminiscent of the boom of the helicopter that landed in Osama bin Laden's front yard. Yeah, you can check it out. We were looking at those pictures when they came back. And our two air officers... you know, F-18, man. Maybe I need to get Metro on. Metro's retired now. I wonder if he'll come on. But Metro, he's got a huge brain. Yeah. Metro's like the brain that ate Moscow. That's how big his brain is. And, so anyway, he and Rudy were looking at the pictures of, so I walked in, I walked in early that day, like at 4:45, and there was like more activity in our COC than normal. And I looked at my counterpart, the Wolf, who now lives in Tulsa, he's a cop. So I look at the Wolf, right, and I said, hey, what's going on? He goes, I think they killed Osama bin Laden. I said, no shit. He said, yeah, the president's coming on pretty soon. So, and then, you know, the question was, well, what's going to happen in Helmand? And the answer was nothing, because people there, they didn't care about Osama bin Laden. They were like, that's your guy. We want Mullah Omar, man. That's our guy. So anyway, there was a lot of activity for no reason, primarily because we didn't understand the culture. But that's a different story. Anyhow, so, you know, there's all this discussion about where was it. Nobody knew shit until the president made his statement. So then we're plotting where they got to, and we're like, wow, that's pretty impressive that they got, right, into Pakistan, right, undetected into Pakistan. That's pretty motivating, right? And so, anyhow, then I want to say the first place I saw him was the Washington Post, had pictures, and probably about a dozen pictures of the of one of the raid, the play, the look of the compound, and an American helicopter had crashed there. There was no Americans left on site, you know, blah 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 blah. So we were looking at the pictures, and the two F-18 guys, right? F-18 guys, so they're like high speed jet guys, right? They were looking at like a monkey looking at high definition TV for the first time. Yeah. And Metro, right, the guy with the big brain, he, and I had these things on my monitor, so they were sitting in front of me. So Metro's got his head craned around my monitor, leaning over my desk, and he's like, holy shit, man. You know, I've read about stuff like that, but I've never seen anything like that. And he could have been lying, right? But I don't think he was. But you see elements of that design in this helicopter. Yeah, so boom. All right, we're going to take a break. No, we're not going to take a break. Should we take a break? No. This is the Q&A from John Bolton. All right, we're going to finish this. And then you're going to hear Lynch and Kenny afterwards, okay? So Bolton made his first public appearance, I want to say, Thursday. So I think it was Monday or Tuesday. At the Center for Strategic and International Relations. He stood up and gave a speech. I played it yesterday. Subsequent to the speech, they did a Q&A. We listened to about, I don't know, 10 minutes of the Q&A. So we'll re-listen to the first 10 minutes, and you'll hear the rest of it. And then after the Q&A, you'll hear Lynch and Kenny talking about war in the South China Sea, what they think. So don't touch that dial. John Bolton, Q&A right now, with me doing analysis.
On the Korea issue and more broadly about U.S. foreign policy in Asia, my name is Victor Cha. I'm the Korea chair here at CS.
Okay, so he gave his speech about North Korea, and really the gist of his speech is the United States should not get intoxicated with the fact that we're actually that we're having conversations with North Korea. While it's easy to be seduced because he's not shooting missiles over mainland Japan right now, or he's not shooting missiles near Guam, the bottom line is this. He has taken no concrete steps towards a path to nuclear disarmament, armament, none. And we should not be seduced by that, as politicians will be when they declare victory and go home, and then after a while you go, wait a minute, we didn't win, we lost. Right, we lost. So here's the Q&A. And again, what's significant is what he just said, and that is the Q&A is going to be about larger Asia security issues.
Yes, I am a professor and vice dean at Georgetown University, and I want to welcome everybody to the CSIS Chungang-Ilbo Forum. I hope that you all stay with us. I know Ambassador Bolton's the main attraction, but I hope you'll stay with us because we have a great day planned, including two additional keynote remarks by former Foreign Minister Song Min-soon and Undersecretary of Defense John Rood. My role here is to facilitate a conversation with Ambassador Bolton based on his remarks, as well as ask you some questions from the audience, which we've collected in advance. My challenge is that you've answered almost all the questions already that I had in mind. But let me begin with where you left off, which is the Japan-Korea relationship. And I guess the question I would have for you initially is, I mean, what specifically should we be doing then? I mean, what should the United States, should we be proposing some sort of solution? As you know, for the Koreans, it's this whole question at least immediately about the white list, and for Japan, it's being the termination of the JISOMIA agreement. I mean, is there anything specifically that you would propose on this? And also, as dysfunctional as this relationship has become, who is benefiting from that?
Well, I think actually the answer to the last question is the easiest. I think China and Russia are benefiting from this split. And it's something they can only take delight in, that this effort to try to weave together a more effective South Korean, Japanese, American presence in the region, bringing others in as well. I think the free and open Indo-Pacific, for example, has been a major conceptual step forward in American policy under this administration. It's all thrown in severe jeopardy by the split. Now, part of the problem in the dispute is that it's asymmetric. From the South Korean side, at least in some parts of the political spectrum, the origin of the split is the perceived unfairness in the 1965 treaty that at least at the time, both sides saw as turning a page in history to say, okay, whatever Japan did before in the 1895 to 1945 period, we're going to resolve, and that's it, and it's finished. That has now been called into question, which obviously causes deep uncertainty about the future relations in Japan. And I might say, it ought to cause everybody here to understand that puts deep uncertainty into any possible Japanese involvement in economic development in North Korea.
I'm not sure what happened. Let me,
C-SPAN, your unfiltered view of government, created by cable in 1979.
Yeah, thank God. Hold on, 2645.
In his first public remarks,
because if anybody thinks the Japanese are going to open their checkbook to North Korea after they thought they had solved that problem with South Korea and saw it unstuck, it's not going to happen. That is a very broad and difficult historical issue to talk about in both countries. Japan responded with economic retaliation that I think took South Korea by surprise. I think it unnerved South Korea. I don't think they understood the risk that they had undertaken when they challenged the 1965 treaty. And then it deteriorated further with the suspension or termination of JSOMIA. So the best I can say at the moment, at least I hope the best I can say, is that they've hit a plateau and things are not deteriorating further. And at this point, I'm not sure that the discussions that are going on have any, the bilateral discussions have any prospect of reversing the conflict as it now stands. So I think there's an awful lot of work to do in trying to get this back on track, and I'm not even sure at this point I would know where to begin. And that's something people should be thinking about, because the longer the split goes on, that I do have confidence I can say weakens all three of us further.
Again, that's an issue that, you know, we talked about with Grant yesterday, and that is the South Korean-Japan split that exists. Last week there was an article about the South Koreans sending federal police or some kind of force to disputed islands that are disputed between them and the Japanese. Like, what? Come on now. There's bigger shit going on than you two, you know, saber rattling against each other. So, again, it's not a small issue in the Pacific.
Thanks. The very last line of your speech, you said that this is not a time for U.S. disengagement from Asia. Do you sense that we are disengaging from Asia?
Well, I think there's a risk of it. I think that, I don't want to make this a partisan comment, but I'll just say in our two great political parties, one of them has a very vestigial national security wing. You don't hear about the Scoop Jackson Democrats anymore. You don't even hear about the Joe Lieberman Democrats anymore. Within the Republican Party, there has always been a residual isolationist component. I would have to be, pains me to say this, but I would have to say that the strength of that component has been rising recently. And the notion that you could have both major parties with a withdrawn sense of American involvement in the world other than more slavish devotion to what the UN General Assembly does, I find very troubling.
you mentioned in your remarks about exercising and readiness. We are in a period now where the U.S. and South Korea have greatly modified or moderated the level of exercising we're doing on the peninsula. You mentioned it could eventually hurt readiness. Maybe it's not happening today, but eventually it will hurt readiness. I guess the question there is, more broadly speaking, do you think that it's a bad policy to be negotiating equities in our alliance for something that I assume you think is not achievable, which is at least the strategic decision by North Korea to pursue denuclearization?
Well, I think the U.S. and its allies should be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. I think it's a high priority for the United States in particular not to let North Korea do as it tries repeatedly to do, to drive a wedge between us and North Korea. Sometimes that's easier for them to do. Sometimes it's harder for them to do. I think it would be better to have an adult conversation on the burden-sharing subject simultaneously with an adult conversation on what we really think Kim Jong-un is going to do. Mm-hmm. And this is a question, obviously, that divides the body politic in both countries. And, we'll see what happens in the next several months. I think on the readiness point, as I say, I'm not making any judgments here myself. But I do think that authoritative voices on this need to be heard. And people need to decide if you're not going to be ready to fight. You know, the slogan of our forces in Korea is fight tonight. And that's the only slogan that they and the South Koreans can have, given the nature of the threat. If they're not ready to fight tonight, I have to ask for the safety of the Americans whether they should be there or not. And that's why this question of the effect of the diminution of the exercises, the effect on military readiness, seems to me to require authoritative study.
When you were last in government during the Bush administration, I remember that you were quite involved in the creation of the first sort of smart sanctions campaign against North Korea. I think back then we called it defensive measures. You were also involved in the creation of PSI, the Proliferation Security Initiative. I'm curious, when you came back into government this time and you saw the portfolio of UN Security Council resolutions on North Korea, is very different from back then when we had basically two, right, 1695 and 1718. So my first question is, do you feel like the current sanctions regime against North Korea is more robust than it was when you were last in government? And is that something that the United States should give up and negotiate away, or is it something that we should hold on to?
Yeah, I think since those two initial resolutions, each time North Korea has detonated a nuclear device or done some other form of testing or taken some other unacceptable action, more sanctions have been imposed. I don't think, frankly, even the way we did it in 1695 and 1718 was right. I think when you impose sanctions incrementally over a long period of time, the country being sanctioned finds ways to mitigate against the sanctions. I think Iran was expert at that, as was North Korea. I think sanctions to be effective have to be imposed massively and then enforced. And that's something we should learn going forward. We now have a body of Security Council resolutions and U.S. statutes that make up this web of sanctions. The issue today is, are they being enforced effectively? Same question you can ask with respect to Iran. And the answer is, they're not being enforced effectively. We've seen the development of something that I'm sure occurred in the past, but which was never much the subject of conversation. We now call ship-to-ship transfers. Ships come out of North Korea, they transfer coal or other materials onto other ships and then take them around the world. Ships coming to North Korea drop off oil onto ships that then take them into port. These ship-to-ship transfers, the same thing is occurring with oil from Iran around the Middle East, take place at sea. They take place sometimes without our knowing about it because our intelligence capabilities are not 100% perfect. And it's a way to evade sanctions. It's very troubling. Now, I think there are steps we can and should take to reduce these ship-to-ship transfers. I think this, in some cases, requires greater cooperation from China and Russia when the ship-to-ship transfers take place in their territorial waters or very close to them. If you're going to have sanctions, make them effective. And if you're not, then get a different policy.
Okay. You know, I know that you're restricted in terms of talking about things while you were in government, but I just want to ask you...
It's a self-imposed restriction.
I'll just ask you a couple of questions which don't touch specifically on it, but more generally. So when you were... When the U.S. leader and the North Korean leader met in Hanoi, that was about... You were 10 months, I think, into your job as National Security Advisor.
Who's counting?
Who's counting? But you have years, if not decades, of experience on this issue, as you made very clear in your remarks. And so I guess the question I wanted to ask you is, you know, was the problem in Hanoi that the North Koreans were not giving enough or that they wanted the United States to give too much?
Well, I can only speak from my personal point of view, having followed this issue for 30 years. I don't think the North Koreans will ever voluntarily give up enough, because what they have to give up to satisfy me is their entire nuclear structure, and they need to agree to an inspection system that is so robust and so thorough that they could well think that it threatens the stability of their regime. I don't want fake inspections. We've got plenty of those around the world as it is now. We need real verification of any agreement, given the untrustworthiness of the North Korean regime since its inception. This is a government that has essentially violated every agreement, every international agreement it has ever made. There is no basis to trust any commitment that that regime makes, absent some fundamental change inside the North Korean system itself.
And do you think, so you mentioned the Libya model in your talk, do you think that the Libya model is possible with a country like North Korea that has advanced so far in terms of its program now? I mean, in Libya's case, you know, they had not reached an operational capability or come close to it. I mean, so, you know, I guess the question when you raise the Libya model would be, is that, it may have been feasible before for North, is it still feasible today?
Well, it's feasible if they conclude that they are better off and safer without this program. If you believe that North Korea has undertaken the development of nuclear weapons not simply for defensive purposes, but because they still believe the North Korean theology, that Korea will be reunited under their rule, there's a very good reason for them to have these capabilities. So if that's the conclusion, then I think you have to look to other methods to do it. And it may be the Libya model is not possible. But what I regard as even worse in a way is pretending that you're getting to a resolution of the nuclear issue when you simply allow North Korea still to have a nuclear capability, but give it enough economic assistance through direct provision of resources or through the release of sanctions that gives the regime a lifeline it currently doesn't have.
So in theory, you're not against incentives under the right circumstances with North Korea.
Yeah, we gave Libya plenty of incentives after they allowed U.S., U.K., and other international personnel to come in and dismantle the nuclear weapons program, which was very limited, as you rightly say, dismantle it, put it on ships and planes, and take it to Oak Ridge, Tennessee, where the Libyan nuclear weapons program now resides. And by the way, where there's plenty of room for the North Korean nuclear weapons program, too.
There's space there.
There sure is.
So then, is so-called romance diplomacy the best way to try to get to that point?
I'm not going to comment on that.
Okay, then...
Nice try.
Okay. Well, let me just ask you another, before I go to the questions that we collected from the audience. So you've met Kim Jong-un. What's he like?
I'd put it this way. I believe he is thoroughly in charge of the country. I have no doubt. I know when his father died and there were a lot of questions, is he sort of a puppet of his relations? Is he controlled by the military? Is he controlled by other factions within North Korea? I think it's clear he's in charge. I think it's clear he makes the decisions, and I think he feels very comfortable in that role.
Right. Okay. So in the remaining time, we do have some questions that we've collected from the audience in advance. Just in terms of efficiency of time, we asked all of you by email for some questions, and we have some. The first comes from our co-host, Chulong Ilbo, and their question is about...
I guess I better answer those.
Yeah. you mentioned burden sharing in your remarks, and you know the United States has asked Korea, at least it's reported, to pay $5 billion in the next SMA agreement. You were, I believe, asked to deliver that news. What do you think is going to happen if the South Koreans can't meet that number?
Well, let me answer in a more general fashion. And this is an issue that I think has real resonance in the United States. I think there is a feeling that we have carried more of the burden than we should have around the world for too long, and that rebalancing what the allocation of particularly financial measures should be is overdue. We have done this before, and I recall vividly in 1990, 1991, during the first Bush administration when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, the United States first through Desert Shield and then through Desert Storm pushed the Iraqis out of Kuwait, liberated the country, and we moved on from there. President Bush 41 decided at a very early stage that the Kuwaitis were going to pay a very substantial part of the liberation of their country. They weren't going to live in fine hotels in London and not bear some share of that cost, and that others should as well, not just countries in the region, but countries like Japan, countries in Europe, and others. And senior American officials, the Vice President, Secretary of State Jim Baker, Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney, were sent around the world to raise money to pay for the liberation of Kuwait. Now, it was, I remember they felt a little embarrassed by it. It was sort of hard to say, okay, Japan, your share is however many billion it was. They called it the tin cup exercise because, as I say, they were a little embarrassed by it. But I think the record, the historical record, will reveal that we made a profit on the first Gulf War. Small profit. We had our cost reimbursed. Some people would say, well, that's just mercenary. Well, I suppose it is, but Kuwait's a free country today, and Saudi Arabia was not invaded. My point is that it's not inappropriate to ask for people to pay a fair share of the cost, and in particular now we are having a debate in the NATO context over appropriate allocation of defense expenditures. And here it's very interesting. In 2014, in the Obama administration, the NATO countries voluntarily agreed that their target for defense expenditures would be 2% of GDP, a target they would all commit to meet by 2024, 10 years later. When the Trump administration came in, that commitment achieved a much higher salience than in the Obama administration. I think all would agree on that. NATO Secretary General Stoltenberg has reported that as a result of the pressure that's been applied, aggregate NATO expenditures for defense from January 20, 2017 forward have increased by over $100 billion. Now that's ex the United States. And that's a very significant increase, even though many countries still are nowhere close to 2% and don't have a path to get to it by 2024. Implicitly, if we are allowing NATO members not to live up to that commitment, while we're spending over 4% of our GDP on global defense, we are subsidizing European welfare systems. That's a very hard case to make to the American people. All we're saying to others is, if you believe in your own self-defense, live up to the commitment you voluntarily made. I remember one European leader at the NATO summit in 2018 said, well, we were trying to move up to get closer to 2% of GDP, but, you know, our economy is growing so fast that it's harder to get there because 2% now is a higher nominal currency figure. Now, so you've got to cut us some slack. That's a statement that's saying we're doing so well economically we can't afford to defend ourselves. It's not acceptable. It's not acceptable. So I would say to Korea and Japan, I think there will be, there should be a rebalancing. You're going to negotiate it out. An opening bid of whatever number is an opening bid. See what happens. But don't think it's business as usual.
Right. The next question comes from Lynn.
Pretty interesting. And again, administrations, after administration has opined about it, right? And done nothing, essentially. Done nothing. So it's interesting. A harder American line. And again, it should not be America's job to defend Germany when Germany won't defend itself. And I don't know why it's lost on the German people, that they should be responsible for being an equal member of NATO and not having a dysfunctional military. I don't get that. And I think the president's message, it should have teeth. It should have teeth.
Lindsay Lloyd at the George W. Bush Institute. He asks, to your knowledge, at any time during his three meetings with Kim, has President Trump raised the issue of human rights? Well, maybe you can speak more broadly to the question whether human rights should be a part of our discussion with North Korea.
Yeah, I'll speak more broadly.
Yeah.
Look, I think it is inherent in America's concept of itself that we believe in free people. I think it's a mistake, and it's one reason, just a little footnote on myself here, it's one reason I am not a neoconservative. I don't think it's our job to promote democracy around the world and impose it on other people. But if asked, what is the American response to the question, what kind of government should we have going to be? It's not going to be, we actually favor monarchy. That's not how we see things. So, of course, we talk in terms of our values. It's inevitable. It's one reason why religious freedom is such an important value for us. So I think it is a factor, like all factors in construing what is in America's national interest, what are our vital national security interests. There's no one value that trumps every other value every single time. But I think it's fair to say that the way a country treats its own people tells you something about the leadership of that country. And it was no accident over the past several decades that there was a high correlation between countries that looked for proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, engaged in support for international terrorism, and repressed their own people.
Okay. And then let me look at the time. The last question, given that we're out of time, is from Nick Schifrin at the PBS NewsHour. And his question is the president patient when it comes to getting a deal with North Korea, or is he over-anxious? Now, I know that you may not answer that question directly, so let me paraphrase it and ask. You did mention in your remarks that time is usually on the proliferant side. So when are we out of time when it comes to North Korea?
Well, I hope we've still got time left, and that's why I read that Churchill quote. When the danger is perceptible and the cost of acting are low, the failure to act guarantees that the threat will grow and the ultimate cost will be higher. Every day that goes by makes North Korea a more dangerous country. You don't like their behavior today? What do you think it'll be when they have nuclear weapons that can be delivered to American cities? Do you want to wait till then to act, or do you want to act now? So when does it become too late? Today is better than tomorrow. Tomorrow is better than the next day.
Ambassador Bolton, thank you for taking the time and for opening our conference.
There you have it, John Bolton, here on a Thursday edition of Auburn Radio. Pretty interesting stuff. And let me just tell you, that he just said, you're going to hear that again on Auburn Radio. You will definitely hear it again. And and it's, when the danger is lower and the consequences of sanctions or action, you know, not the consequences, are great. If you fail to act during that time, right, you only guarantee that you will have to act later, and that is the lesson of World War II in the 20th century. Yet, we seem not to have learned that lesson. And so, that was a good quote. All right, we're going to take a break. I've got to fix a little piece of audio, and so we'll take a break, and you should not notice it. But don't touch that dial. Jeff Kenney, Tim Lynch coming up next. We're going to talk about if war breaks out in the South China Sea, what does it look like? Does it proliferate around the world? Do other people throw in? What happens? So you're going to hear them wax eloquent about that subject. So don't touch that dial. More Ball Marine Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.